Hang around for enough elections and you realize we frequently discuss and debate immigration policy. This year is no different. It's a good bet immigration would have been in the mix of issues, even without discussions of building a wall on the Mexican border, as has been suggested. Our first guest today has a long view of immigration law in America. Dr. Dan Tischner is the Philip Knight Chair of Political Science at the University of Oregon. He's the author of Dividing Lines, The Politics of Immigration Control in America, and an editor of the Oxford Handbook of the Politics of International Migration. Our chat with him today kicks off a regular segment spotlighting research at the University of Oregon. We call it Curious, Research Meets Radio. Dan Tischner, welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So build the wall, finish the fence. It seems like we've heard variations for years, and these are not by any means, it sounds like, recent sorts of discussions.
No, not at all. We've actually been debating this since the founding of the Republic, so absolutely. This is something that we have kind of wrestled with as a country, for decades. And nothing new in terms of this election. I think the tone of this election, obviously, it's been more front and center, and it's rare to have presidential candidates discuss the issue as frequently as we have recently.
If not presidential candidates, does it tend to get discussed more in congressional campaigns or more local issues or where?
Yeah, well, I mean, absolutely. It's typically been discussed, in local and congressional elections. Rarely have we seen presidential candidates take it up so directly. And usually when they have, if a particular candidate has taken a position that's been viewed as hostile to immigrants and been punished at election time for it, usually there's been a pivot by the next campaign. And so this one really stands out because this will be the second election in a row in which the Republican standard bearer has taken a position that might tempts political punishment by Latino and Asian voters. So that kind of stands out compared to past elections.
The usual pivot being away from immigration issues or a softening of the stance?
Correct. So if you want to go way back in time, in the 1830s, Henry Clay took a position that was taking on the Irish Catholics, and the result was that by the next election, the party had pivoted to be careful. Likewise, if you fast forward to the late 19th century, the Republican Party got in some trouble, raising problems again about Irish Catholics, and the result was that by the next election, the Republican Party was very careful to avoid seeming anti-Catholic. So that has been the norm, and you can fast forward to the 1990s, in which Bob Dole in 1996 was viewed as taking positions that were...
We seem to have a phone problem there. We're going to have to reconnect Dan Tischner get him back on the line for our segment called Curious, Research Meets Radio. Dan Tischner is a political scientist at the University of Oregon, to be specific, the Philip Knight Chair of Political Science at the U of O. He's the author of Dividing Lines, The Politics of Immigration Control in America, and an editor of the Oxford Handbook of the Politics of International Migration. As you have just heard already, it is not new for political campaigns to be discussing immigration, although there tends to be a bit of a softening in stance as you move from one election to the next, as there was the perception that Mitt Romney was punished by a loss in the 2012 presidential election with his focus on immigration. The usual pivot is away from it, and Donald Trump's position on immigration is a bit more arch than that, a bit more punitive. Interesting, too, as you sit here and hear about the sets of people who were deemed to be the targets of wanting to keep immigrants out of the country in previous elections. Henry Clay, as you heard, in the early part of the 19th century, talking about immigration or slowing the immigration of Irish Catholics, which certainly strikes a guy named Riley funny sitting here. Let's get your thoughts as we continue the discussion. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Got the phone kinks sorted out. Dan Tischner back with us. So you were talking about Bob Dole in 1996 and his positions on immigration.
Well, so Bob Dole was, very statesmanlike throughout his career on a variety of issues, including immigration. But in that election, we may forget that California throughout the 90s was engulfed in lots of intense debate on this issue. Proposition 187 was a very popular referenda that called for denying undocumented immigrants access to various public benefits, passed by large majorities. And so by 1996, his party platform called for denying citizenship to the children of undocumented immigrants and taking a hard line on that issue. Senator Dole himself, again, was much more moderate on it, but felt he had to actually take a position. And Clinton, Bill Clinton, hammered away on this issue throughout the campaign and cast Senator Dole, like the rest of his party, as too extreme. The result was a huge boost in the Democratic proportion of Latino and Asian votes. And so then by 2000, you have an example of this pivot that we were discussing earlier, in which the Republican Party shifted. George W. Bush, as the standard bearer, emphasized that during his tenure as governor of Texas, that he had been very immigrant-friendly, wanted to match willing workers with willing employers, as he put it, and the Republican Party was able to recapture a significant portion of that new immigrant vote, and what's really crucial is kindred ethnic voters, so that Latino and Asian voters who had been in this country for generations have tended to be very defensive of immigration policies that are more friendly and immigrant rights. So that's why the last two elections really stand out.
Mm-hmm. Dan Tischner, when we think about the term nation of immigrants, I mean, in fact, pretty much anybody who doesn't have Native American blood can point to ancestors offshore. Does the idea, though, that we are largely made up of immigrants pale after a generation or two? Do we kind of forget and want to shut the door behind us?
Well, I don't think we forget. I mean, what's really striking is how much our country really embraces its immigrant past. And so you can think about all the iconography surrounding immigration that is really crucial to our self-conception as a people. So the Statue of Liberty and Ellis Island and so forth. What really stands out is the extent to which we tend to embrace that immigrant past, but feel very uneasy about the immigrant present. That is, the newest kids on the block have always upset Americans, you know, from the 19th century all the way to present. And in fact, we tend to be a people who view immigration itself as a virtuous process, but then look askance among those who are the most recent benefits of opening the gates.
Are the concerns about immigration in the present tense constant? I mean, is it usually something like jobs lost to new workers and economic concerns like that?
Well, certainly there, you know, usually there are three things that are, for those who are the most concerned about new immigration, that they point to. One is exactly what you say, which is concern about job competition and work conditions. A second is there's always been some level of cultural anxiety that that folks who are new aren't quite like the rest of us. And we've been saying this since the time of, you know, when the Chinese arrived to help build the railroads, when the Irish Catholics arrived, all the way to present. And then a third area is we've always been jittery about national security and have viewed immigrants as somehow potentially security threats. And that was true, again, you know, across time, very much during World War One, we were, you know, hot and bothered about German Americans. And, you know, we had, German musicians who were fired from orchestras, German teachers removed from schools. We had phrases like, you know, sauerkraut became freedom cabbage. Hamburgers became freedom sausage to remind us of, liberty sausage to remind us of the freedom fries and so forth. So,
right.
You know, these kinds of anxieties have a long history in this country.
We're talking immigration with Dan Tischner at the University of Oregon. He's a political scientist, the Philip Knight Chair of Political Science at the U of O. In our new segment called Curious, Research Meets Radio, join us on the exchange to talk about immigration through history. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So what happened 3 years ago? The Senate passed comprehensive reform and then sent it to the House, and then did it just die there?
Well, it did, and the Senate, has tended to be much more bipartisan on this issue during the last quarter century compared to the House, which is far more partisan, ideologically divided, especially when it comes to immigration. I think House members are much closer to their base on this, and so 3 years ago we had a so-called Gang of Eight, four Republicans and four Democrats, who wanted to basically advance a grand bargain on the issue that involved tough compromises for both sides. But in the House, it basically was dead on arrival.
Now, that's because the Republican leadership wouldn't bring it to the floor. Is it likely between a few Republicans and a lot of Democrats it had enough votes to actually pass the House if it had been introduced?
I think that's quite right, that it may have been able to eke to victory. But it is always very tough to get comprehensive immigration reform through because it involves, some bitter pills on all sides when it comes to how to address the issue. And so usually comprehensive reform, is comprised of, some sort of enforcement measures, enhancing the border, dealing with employment questions for undocumented immigrants, including sanctions for employers. And on the other side, some form of legalization. So that's always been a very hard compromise to get through.
So in one sense, you're trying to slam the door and say there'll be nobody else who gets through like the people who already got through. As for the people who already got through, we're going to give them a pass to citizenship, which does include fines and back taxes and things like that.
Right. And, one of the real challenges basically since the last time we did significant reform in this area, which was in 86, has been a lot of cynicism about the fact that last time we did this, there was a sense that legalization was going to be a one-time-only reform, and that employer sanctions, as passed in 86, were said to be, the solution. It ended up being a toothless tiger. And so as a result, I think two things are really striking about where most Americans stand on this, according to polling. The first is that most actually have more faith or more support for extending some kind of legalization to the 10 to 14 million undocumented immigrants in the country right now. And that's very different from 86, where the vast majority of Americans opposed any kind of legalization program. So we've seen a real shift in that area. But at the same time, the same polls show that most Americans are deeply cynical about the will and capacity of the government to control its borders.
Which gets back to an area that doesn't seem to get explored perhaps as much as the others. We tend to focus on the people who come across the border, not the destinations they might be going to. And you did mention some effects on employers in the 86 reform legislation. How hard does any reform effort, whether passed or not, come down on employers for not being completely straightforward about the people they're attracting and the people that they're hiring?
Well, I mean, that's been, quite uneven. The first time federal lawmakers started to focus on trying to address unauthorized immigration through employment was in the 50s. And the idea was that if you could take away the magnet of jobs, that might provide a disincentive for people to come across porous borders. But it got nowhere in the 50s. And it wasn't until, again, in the 70s it got proposed again. But it took us until 86 to actually pass the first real significant federal employer sanctions legislation. And without getting too much into the weeds of this, the key limitation of the 86 reform was that to be able to make employer sanctions work according to the designer's idea was that you needed to have a secure system of employee eligibility, a way to verify whether someone was eligible to work. And that was really never established in 86. So that's why it became viewed as something that was, you know, not very effective in its implementation. And so there's more faith now among supporters of employer sanctions that we have a system called Real ID that allows for a kind of a computerized system to check whether someone's eligible. But that also has had some hiccups. So it is an open question whether sanctions will work in the long run.
Dan Tischner, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about immigration. He is a political scientist at the University of Oregon in our research segment called Curious, Research Meets Radio. Join us on the Exchange in the few minutes we've got left, 800-838-3760 by phone. Email jx@jeffnet.org. I read your piece in The Atlantic from May about Lyndon Johnson's efforts on immigration. Did what he ended up with, like civil rights legislation, play a big part in party realignment in the South turning solidly Republican over the course of the next 35 years?
I don't think it had the same effect in terms of party realignment. Maybe over the, for instance, one of the reasons why I don't think it had an immediate effect is that the 65 law dramatically changed the system by which people could get admitted, what the preference structure would be. Up to that point, we had something called national origins quotas, which really explicitly selected people on the basis of what country they were born in and tended to favor Northern and Western Europeans. After the 65 law, that changed dramatically to emphasize whether an individual had family ties here. So immediate family of U.S. citizens and permanent residents, brothers, sisters, and others. And initially, they didn't expect that to actually favor those from outside of Europe. They thought it would have a significant impact, for mostly for Europeans. So it wasn't for several, you know, for several years that it actually ended up helping through chain migration, Asian and Latino immigrants.
You say that the next president will not be able to avoid immigration action. Why not?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's really striking how the degrees of freedom for presidents on this issue have become quite limited. You know, as recently as President Reagan and President Bill Clinton, those chief executives had the ability to and preference to actually let Congress take the lead and react to Congress on this. Essentially, and if you look at the current campaign, both candidates have made promises and have a sense of urgency surrounding this issue that makes it impossible for either of them to avoid tackling immigration reform. They've made it, you know, center stage among their commitments. But even prior to this, President Obama, through his executive action, basically makes it impossible for a president not to take some kind of response, either by continuing the temporary executive actions he's taken or to rescind them.
Well, then you got the Supreme Court involved with not being able to overrule a lower court decision, stopping some of President Obama's executive actions. So there's another jumble of stuff in there based on who gets chosen for the empty Supreme Court seat.
Absolutely. And so, you know, basically, as the Supreme Court takes shape, one of the key issues that it's going to need to decide is the constitutionality of independent executive actions that provide temporary relief for certain undocumented immigrants. So DACA, the deferred action for childhood arrivals, basically younger undocumented immigrants who meet certain conditions, was something that Obama issued in during the 2012 year of his administration. And so whoever comes in is going to have to decide what to do long-term about DACA. And then there's another measure, as you were mentioning, that was aimed at largely the parents of those young undocumented immigrants. You know, right now it's sort of in abeyance, but the next president's going to have to decide what he or she wants to do.
A couple seconds left here, Dan Tischner. How resonant does the build the wall cry appear to you in the general body of the electorate, as opposed to just the people who go to Trump rallies?
Well, again, you know, public opinion is really interesting on this because if, you know, for decades you could see broad support for measures that would restrict immigration. And what we've seen in the past 10 years is large majorities of Americans, some in the area of 55 to 65, embracing broader immigration opportunities. So the build the wall perspective is not shared by most Americans.
All right. We will see what shapes up down the road. A lot of history we got here from Dan Tischner, University of Oregon political scientist. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
My pleasure.
All right. Take care.